In November of 1988, just one day after Halloween, the city of Lancaster, California, was inundated with 263 letters that sent a chill through the community. The letters demanded that prominent residents, quote, pay or die.
Join me. You may be able to help solve a mystery.
Welcome to You Solved a Mystery. I'm Athena.
And I'm Chandra.
And today, Chandra has another chilling mystery to share.
I don't know if this is too chilling, but it is a former mystery.
Well, the cold opening was pretty chilling.
Yay! So I have an episode to share with you. Unfortunately, it was not included in the re-edited Unsolved Mystery. So
there are so many of those. And I know that for one of them, it's an issue of a person who was accused of a crime suing everyone, whoever implies that they did the crime. But there are so many segments that aren't available anymore, and I just wonder why.
That sounds like that guy from the documentary Sophie, A Murder in West Cork.
What does?
The guy, the suspect, he kept suing people.
Oh.
And it's like, it would have died down, but he just could not give up his 15 minutes of fame for being a suspected murderer. Anyway, the guy was a dirtbag. For this story, though, fortunately, there is unsolvedmysteries.fandom.com to give me a rundown.
Doing God's work.
So at the time of airing, 263 high-profile residents of Lancaster, California had received anonymous letters demanding that they send money to various addresses. The letters were crude and rude, threatening to kill the recipient and family if they didn't comply. According to the fandom site, each letter contained the same warning, and I'm not sure if this was verbatim in every letter, but it went like this. The police cannot protect you every minute of the day, month, and year. If you decide not to pay, we'll blow your brains out.
Yikes.
As I was researching, I saw the total numbers of letters reported at 265 and 267. Unsolved Mysteries said 263. It doesn't actually seem like that important of a detail, so I don't know why I'm repeating it.
Was it the same amount of money in each one?
No, it was different amounts of money.
Weird.
They were all postmarked November 1st in Kern County.
It's a lovely county.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
The letters were produced on a word processor, which in 1988 were available, but still not terribly common in private ownership. It could have been a computer with a word processing program. But at the time, people were still using the original word processors, which were machines. Whole big machines, like an old-fashioned computer, except the only thing that it did was run a typing program. So this is actually something that would have stood out to investigators, that the writers had access to a word processor.
Wow.
The scheme of the letters was to demand that money be sent to other prominent citizens in the Antelope Valley. So you, prominent figure, have to send money to this other prominent figure. And that person had also received their own letter demanding that they send the money on to another prominent person. The letters instructed some of the recipients to buy CB radios, travel to Las Vegas, and then listen for instructions.
That seems out of left field.
The Desert Dispatch reported that according to Deputy District Attorney Steve Cooley, much of the letter content was identical, but the writer would add personal information about each recipient. The letters began with obscenities and death threats, And after the demand for money, they would go on to describe gruesome scenarios for the recipient's death and threaten family members, in some cases, including their children.
I'm very intrigued and excited to find out who was doing this, because it sounds like some sort of inside job of like another prominent figure kind of punking everyone. But I guess I'll find out.
You will find out. I genuinely have, I don't know what to tell you yet. We'll get there when we get there, and we'll see how you feel about it.
Also, I feel like we've talked about Stephen Cooley before. Maybe another story in California.
We'll have to take a look back and...
Well, I just looked him up. He was the Los Angeles district attorney from 2000 to 2012. So it would make sense that we would know his name. He was also a Republican who said he would defend Proposition 8, banning same-sex marriages. And when he ran for California Attorney General, he lost to San Francisco District Attorney Kamala Harris.
Suck it.
Yeah.
The gays are getting married.
The gays are getting married.
Get over it.
Get over it. Also, marriage equality won't be real until disabled people can get married without losing benefits. Continue with your story, please.
Back to the story. Some of the letter recipients left town to go into hiding. Many never spoke to the press, but Lancaster City Manager James Gilley spoke out about the trauma of the threats against his children. He was quoted in the Escondido Times Advocate saying, quote, "It's pretty awful when you have to go to school and tell the teachers, please don't let my children out of the classroom until we're here to pick them up. Or to tell the soccer coaches, don't let them leave until we're here," end quote. Eileen Malucho was one of the few who appeared in the segment for Unsolved Mysteries. She had recently been through her own tragedy. On August 1st of 1988, her husband, Lancaster Mayor Nicholas J. Malucho, collapsed due to a massive heart attack while at dinner with Eileen and his vice mayor, George Theopanis. The vice mayor told the Press Democrat, quote, "He leaned over onto his wife Eileen like he always does, joking. She said, 'Nick, will you stop doing that?' She pushed him and he fell down on the table," end quote. Malucho had just been elected mayor in April, and hours before dying, he had thrown the ceremonial first pitch during Lancaster Day at Dodger Stadium. So I guess at some point in history, people thought Lancaster was worth celebrating. As a side note, Malucho had lived in Lancaster since being stationed at Edwards Air Force Base in 1956, which is the same base that brought me and my spouse to suffer the hellish heat and isolation of Lancaster, California. Mm-hmm. I did not enjoy my time in Lancaster.
It's a bit barren.
It is empty. It is hot. And for a long period while I was in Lancaster, I didn't have a car. And so in order to get out of the house and preserve my sanity, I would try to walk places. And I would frequently have men stop me. At one point, a guy actually started following me home, asking for my number, and would not take a no as an answer. So I'd just like to say, men, please tell your other men to stop.
Mm-hmm. Didn't I tell you? So here in Fort Worth, Texas, I have had this experience of getting approached at gas stations a lot, with men asking for my number. And like, I have a hard time just saying no or go away or something like that. But well, I've gotten it's better.
It's kind of scary.
Yeah.
But I don't know how someone is going to react to rejection.
Yes, it is. It is. There is a part of me that doesn't want to be mean. And that's a part of me that probably needs to go to sleep somewhere in the depths, because I'm more important than being mean. But I have gotten better. And the last time it happened, like, the guy came up and was like, "Hey, wait, can I get your number?" And I was already in my car with the window down a little bit. And I was like, No, thank you.
No, thank you.
No, thank you. And like, I said it apologetically a little bit, like, no, thank you. I was like, fuck yeah. No, no, you get a no. You get a no. You get a no. Everybody gets a no.
That just kind of reminded me at work today. Someone called to try to get some information, and I told them we didn't have it. And she was trying to say, no problem, thanks. And she wound up saying, no thanks. Oh, it was great. We laughed.
Thanks for shopping with us. You too. That's like one of those situations.
Yeah. Yep. When you kind of want to go curl up somewhere and cease to exist. Mm-hmm. But back to Eileen and Nicholas. Melucho had been to the doctor about a month before the heart attack and found he had high cholesterol. But according to a statement from his brother, Michael, he wouldn't stop smoking.
Makes sense.
Otherwise, as far as Michael knew, his brother's heart was fine. But in the letter Eileen received, which demanded she send 300,000 in denominations of 10s and 20s, there was also a disturbing suggestion as to her husband's cause of death, that he had actually been poisoned, and the writers had a contract on Eileen's life as well.
It's just so over the top to send 250 plus letters to different people demanding money and being very rude and quite frightening. Did anyone ever send money? Maybe you'll get to that. Did they say where to send money?
Yeah, they told them to send money to other people. So these were like doctors and lawyers and politicians and whatnot. And they would tell this lawyer to send money to this doctor. And they'd also have sent a letter to that doctor telling them to send money to this politician. And this politician was instructed to buy a CB radio and drive to Las Vegas and wait further instruction.
Okay. So it all come down to some specific people who were supposed to actually go, like, take the money.
Yeah.
And go to a place? Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
The letters had some very specific graphic threats. One letter warned the recipient that the writers would, quote, fertilize your fruit trees with your decaying body, end quote. And we are experts in poison. We can put toxic chemicals in your toothpaste or glue laced with poison cyanide on envelopes and stamps that you lick, end quote. Another letter appeared to have knowledge of an affair, stating, quote, if you decide not to pay, we will blow your brains out and then contact your wife or the girlfriend of yours. Read names of those who did not cooperate with us in the obituaries. The organization has watched this area over a year, and we know that you can pay. Do not mess with us. We will kill you, end quote.
So bold and so aggressive.
Especially for just a piece of paper.
And a pretty small town.
The investigation went from going nowhere to following up on an anonymous tip to a police hotline. The caller claimed that two acquaintances had bragged about sending the extortion letters. From there, according to police spokesperson Bob Riley, quote, it was follow-up on the leads and plain old footwork by the detectives, end quote. Jack Jones, who was one of the reporters covering the story for the LA Times, wrote that investigators realized that one intended recipient had died 6 months before the letters. And some letters were sent to addresses where the recipients hadn't lived for 6 months to a year or ever.
So, like, they had been written 6 months in advance?
It looked like the information that the writers had was out of date.
Huh.
Some out of date, some straight up incorrect.
But that could mean that they'd been written that far ahead of time.
Potentially. I mean, I don't know how long it took to print 263 letters off of an old-fashioned word processor.
took 6 months to print the letter.
One of the deputies on the case, Catherine Nielsen, said some of the references made in the letters were readily available in local newspapers. So investigators determined that the writers weren't actually aware of the day-to-day movements of the recipients. They were able to use the date of the one recipient's death to figure out where the letter writers may have gotten the mailing list of prominent figures.
Hmm. So the one that had died 6 months earlier helped to lead them to where they might have gotten their information?
Yep.
I'm so puzzled by this whole thing.
Well, the puzzlement grows because there has not been much information released about the two individuals who were named in that anonymous tip. Two laid-off Rockwell International flight line technicians, Roman Makuch and Richard Ferroni. I couldn't even figure out how to pronounce Makuch's name. I figured out that it's Polish for linseed oil cake.
What's his first name?
Roman.
Roman linseed oil cake.
It might be apologies to the Polish Makuch.
I'll go with it.
But seeing that he was living in the United States, it was probably pronounced Makuch. That'd be my guess. Makuch and Ferroni were known as Rocky and Bullwinkle. I'm assuming that Makuch was Bullwinkle as he was 6'7", one of the few bits of information I could find about him. The two had been in Lancaster for 3 years and continued their friendship after they were laid off. Hmm. Reports said that they weren't well known to the community, but also a writer for the Los Angeles Times reported that Makuch helped coach a little league team, and the pair also took a college photography class and served on the Antelope Valley Film Board. Hmm. So I just don't understand the contradictions here. I don't understand why I can't find more information about them or why nobody claimed to know them. But alas, here we are. And maybe I'm just not a good detective.
No, it's just one of those things where it was so long ago and such a niche situation that the news didn't travel far and wide.
Maybe if I could figure out where they wound up, I could make more specific requests, but that seems like a lot of work.
We don't know where they wound up.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Okay, you gotta keep going because I'm intrigued.
I also found I sort of had an answer to my own question about why maybe people didn't associate with them. The New York Times reported that Makuch and Ferroni were described as inhabiting, quote, a world of weapons, movies, science fiction, law enforcement, computers, and surveillance technology, end quote. And so science fiction and movies, great. Computers, mm-hmm. Awesome. Mm-hmm. Keep your law enforcement over there, away from me. But if I met someone who seemed to be into a world of weapons and surveillance technology, I think that I would politely keep my distance as well.
It sounds like a dangerous combination. Like, there are people who are into this sci-fi fantasy thing and then also law enforcement and like weapons and whatnot. And it winds up being a bad situation.
It winds up being a bad.
Yeah, it just winds up being a bad.
It's being a bad.
It's bad.
It's a bad. So the twists and turns continue where Makuch and Ferroni were actually out of town at the time the letters were postmarked.
Mm-hmm.
They were visiting Ferroni's family in Connecticut.
Did they glue them to the tops of the mailboxes with glue that they made themselves so that after 6 months they would drop down into the mailbox and get it sent?
That is brilliant, and I suspect that maybe you should reach out to the Antelope Valley detectives and see if they considered that.
Are you saying I should become a criminal?
I'm not saying you shouldn't become a criminal. And you probably shouldn't, though.
Let's see. Life goals if grad school doesn't work out. A nonprofit retirement home for cats called Memories. A forest witch. Criminal. Huh? I think I got some good plans in my life.
So those are some good backups.
You got a pencil, thin mustache, and a reptilian demeanor. If I could squeeze a nickel from it, I'd take Grandma to the cleaner.
Riders in the sky.
Because the plot demands an evil man. Moving on.
Moving on to go listen to Riders in the Sky.
Saturday morning.
With Riders in the Sky. You won't regret it. It was reported that Ferroni claimed his father had asked him to visit a week before they left for the trip. But Ferroni's father said that he hadn't spoken to his son until 2 days before the visit, on October 25th, when Ferroni called out of the blue to say he would be there for his first visit since 1985. It was 3 years, and all of a sudden he's like, hey, Dad, we're going to be there in 2 days. So timing is a wee bit suspicious. While in Connecticut, Ferroni left a friend in L.A. a very strange message that it was important that they talk. But when the friend returned his call, Ferroni only talked about the weather. Ferroni had been an Army communications expert due to his, quote, exceptional intelligence and memory, end quote. Which I found interesting due to the fact that the letters were rife with grammatical errors. But I guess that might have been an attempt at a red herring.
Oh, there were two of them involved, right?
Yeah.
So maybe the other one wrote the letters? That wouldn't really make sense. You would think the one who was good at the stuff would be like, let me get in there for a second.
My mental image is two guys in a small room that is just, there's paper everywhere. There's paper tacked on the walls, just piles of paper against all corners. And then this gigantic machine that's a word processor. And it's literally just spitting out piece of paper after piece of paper. And the screen, the text is so large on the screen that it only shows like 10 words at a time.
It would be one of those reams of paper that they're all connected to each other.
Oh, that's a good point.
And
okay, it's altering my mental image a bit.
The little dots on the side.
Yep, we got
it. Just spewing out like a streamer.
We're there. Yep. So investigators suspected that Ferroni's weird-ass call to L.A. from Connecticut was intended to create an alibi, and that McCooch and Ferroni actually had an accomplice put the letters in the mail. An article in the Desert Dispatch read, quote, a search of their apartment and a nearby storage facility turned up computers, printers, and computer disks, a handgun, and several CB radios.
They were advanced for their time.
When I was reading this, I just couldn't get over how these things, computers, printers, and computer disks, were the smoking guns of 1988. Because they just weren't that common. And now everybody has a computer on them at all times. We've got many versions of computers, tablets, like the one I'm reading off right now, while I have an actual laptop over in the living room. Of course, I can't print anything because I have a printer, but it sucks.
I think that they've made printers worse over the years. As a ploy to make you buy more printers.
They've certainly gotten more expensive since I last bought one like 10 years ago.
Big printer is out to get all of us. Watch out. It is the new conspiracy. Don't you buy into their ink. Don't you buy their ink. Okay. Just handwrite.
All right. While you build on that conspiracy, I'm going to continue.
Okay.
I found this nifty website, ourworldindata.org, that had information about the popularity of computers in United States homes. And the data started in 1992, but at that time, in the 90s, only 20% of homes had computers. So you've got to assume that in 88, it was fewer than 20%.
Wow.
So this is actually like a fairly significant piece of evidence. Mm-hmm. Just the fact that they have the ability to print text. The technology was expensive, and a lot of the time only businesses could afford it. So it was actually suspicious that these two guys who already had other connections to things like owning guns actually had one.
So they found their computers and guns and whatnot, and they were like, well, if you have guns and computers, you must be up to no good.
You must be a criminal. Open your book of what a criminal looks like.
This is flip. Too
guns much and computers.
Technology for a normal person.
I don't know if they ever actually found their letter template or their actual word processor, but it was all probably saved on a floppy disk.
It was like
that floppy
disk. 1 foot by 1 foot.
It's out there somewhere and it has all the answers. McCooch and Froney were arrested in Las Vegas on November 24th, 1988.
Las Vegas. Okay. Where they were telling everyone to go. They just wanted to live large. I get it. I see where you're coming from. But you were very rude. Sirs. So now they're in Vegas.
Yep. They were arrested in Vegas. McCooch and Froney were initially charged with conspiracy and 20 other felonies.
Oh, whoa.
Ultimately, they wound up being charged with conspiracy to commit extortion, 10 counts of attempted extortion, and sending threatening letters for extortion purposes. The max sentence was 6 years. They waived extradition from Las Vegas and bail was set at $100,000. They remained in custody. And this all happened in 1988, but McCooch and Froney didn't go to trial until April of 1990. Michael Kilgore told Deputy District Attorney Cooley that he had become friends with McCooch and Froney because they all kept late hours.
Who's Michael Kilgore?
I suspect that Michael Kilgore is the person who called in the tip. But I'm just making guesses here. He testified at their trial that in October of 1988, McCooch had refused him entry to his home at gunpoint. And why Kilgore needed access to McCooch's house with such urgency that McCooch would pull a gun on him was not explained. I mean, I can understand if, like, you get to your friend's house and you really, really gotta pee. It'd be kind of weird if they pulled out a gun and were like, you can't come in.
So Kilgore got to McCooch's house and McCooch was like, I don't think so.
Yeah.
That's
what Kilgore says.
Real rude people.
Kilgore had worked in electronics, and at the time at McCooch's house, he noticed the odor that computers gave off after extended use back in those days.
Wow.
And saw printers and paper inside. He also said that the pair had given him the impression that they were spending their nights conducting surveillance for body hunters. Bounty hunters.
He's gonna be like, what?
Surveillance for bounty hunters.
wait, is this suddenly the 1800s and we're digging up graves?
I do What's really want to go on a tangent of some sort of explanation of what a body hunter is. It's a lot more exciting than, like, I don't know, looking for models or something, but
Wait, there's an actual thing that is a body hunter?
Well, there's something that's similar to body hunter, but it has to do with looking for, like, models or actors. Headhunter, that's what it is.
Oh.
Anywho. A bail bondsman claimed that the pair had wanted to go into business with him and testified that he had told them how to get information through real estate and other public records. Additionally, Lawrence Mock, a former co-worker on the flight line, shared about how he, McCooch, and Ferroni used to, quote, concoct fantastic scenarios for the perfect crime, end quote. So it seemed like possibly they had used requests for public records, such as real estate, to get their list for the letters. And then, you know, I don't really know what Lawrence Mock had to do with anything, because who doesn't sit around and concoct fantastic scenarios for the perfect crime? But again, I digress. Ferroni's father also testified during the trial against Ferroni. Ferroni Jr. also claimed that the CB radios that were found in his possession in that storage unit were actually supposed to be gifts for family that he forgot to take with him to Connecticut.
Huh. It's not the worst gift. It's a bit niche.
I don't know. It could be fun.
It could be. Absolutely.
Could get into that.
Still niche.
A newspaper editor provided testimony that was pretty sketch. He claimed that his analysis of the grammar and writing style in the extortion letters versus a short story written by McCooch indicated that they could have been written by the same person. They could have. Understandably, Ferroni's defense said, oh, hell no, you're going to need someone with credentials if you want to try to make that BS fly. Not a direct quote. Ferroni's defense attorney, William Clark, believed that they would be absolved at trial. He was one of the few prominent figures in Lancaster who didn't get a letter. He said, quote, the evidence they have is very tenuous, end quote. Clark felt that the prosecution would need to produce the accomplice who mailed the letters and how the cohort planned to actually collect. One of McCooch's defense attorneys, Carl Berkow, said of the case, quote, it looks good going in, but when you get down to it, there's nothing that links these guys to the crime, end quote.
So there's nothing actually linking the two people, is what he's saying.
Correct. And that is something that kind of bothered me. Like, there is circumstantial evidence. There's the word processor and CB radios. But I am of a world where we get fingerprints and DNA.
Mm-hmm.
The case was heard by San Fernando Superior Court Judge Ronald S. Cohen without a jury at the request of the defense attorneys. The trial lasted for 18 days. It was reported that the judge felt there were too many contradictions between McCooch and Ferroni's testimonies and those of testimonies of friends and relatives. He was quoted saying, quote, I have spent a great amount of time on this case, studying the evidence and the transcripts, and I gave great weight to the defendant's testimony and their demeanor on the stand, and I find the defendants guilty.
Hmm.
On March 16th, 1990, McCooch and Ferroni were sentenced to 4 years in prison, but one paper reported that they had actually already served nearly half their sentence, as they'd been incarcerated while awaiting trial, and could be out in a year with good behavior.
What were they sentenced to again?
4 years.
Okay, yeah. Because they'd been in for 2 years just waiting for trial.
Yeah, talk about a right to a speedy trial.
Mm-hmm. A huge number of incarcerated people are people who have not been found guilty for any sort of crime. They're just people who can't afford bail to be able to wait for trial, etc., outside of incarceration. It's all part of the broken system.
Both defense attorneys felt that the evidence was weak and circumstantial, and that the two were convicted because they liked to have conversations about what a perfect crime would look like. We're in trouble, Athena. Sebastian Rotella, who covered a lot of the case for the LA Times, said that McCooch and Ferroni were portrayed as, quote, bright loners with a penchant for electronics, guns, and cloak and dagger schemes, end quote. Generally, they were pretty much seen as weirdos.
So what was the motivation of the 250 plus extortion letters?
Unfortunately, based on what I could find, we never heard anything from McCooch or Ferroni. It doesn't seem like they've ever spoken about the crimes or talked about any kind of motive.
So they didn't testify at their trial?
I do not believe so.
It's supposed to be the smart thing to do, but
not
why?
Testifying, yeah. The former Lancaster mayor, this is a name I should have looked up. Bozigian. I'm sorry, Lou. Lou theorized that the extortionist hoped that some recipients would die after receiving the letters and then use that to make other victims believe they were truly dangerous.
Wait. Were the prominent people just all elderly?
You know, they call it old money, right?
This is such a bizarre story.
It's not that out there, really, to think that someone could have had a heart attack after reading a letter threatening that their decaying body was going to become fertilizer for fruit trees. I'd need to take a minute.
Such a weird plan, though, still.
Some people thought that it was just a wild prank. During the trial, Deputy District Attorney Cooley argued that the pair resented the prominent members of the community. They'd tried to raise funds to start an Antelope Valley film studio, but the film commission's director, Stephanie Abrahamson, testified that she had, quote, been stymied in efforts to get financial support to attract movie companies to Lancaster and Palmdale, end quote. Cooley suggested that, quote, they wanted money. Our theory is that they wanted to make the scheme, as bizarre as it was, work. He believed that there were only 10 or 15 genuine targets in the scheme, and the rest were included to throw off investigators.
While they were very aggressive letters and a very aggressive approach in general, it didn't really go anywhere.
That is the thing. Yeah, they were nasty letters that a lot of people got, and they were very upsetting, especially like threatening children, threatening to poison people. It would definitely create paranoia.
Did any of them go to Vegas?
Nope. No one went to Vegas. Nobody lost money.
Nobody paid, and the letter writers just never followed up like, hey, you were supposed to be there.
Well, if it was McCooch and Ferroni, they couldn't. They were arrested less than a month later. Our old friend Lou, who thought that they had hoped people would die after reading the letters, also believed that McCooch and Ferroni had been working with someone who was more involved in the community. And regarding whether the two would walk, he said, quote, I would guess that, yes, somebody in the Antelope Valley is probably sweating right now. End quote. But that's it. As far as I can tell, McCooch and Ferroni did their time and never made the headlines again.
They did a massive operation on a big, expensive computer, got zero turnout, and went to jail.
The whole thing just feels unsatisfying. I'm sorry that this is what I wound up researching to create an episode.
It was such a bad plan that the suspicious part of me is like, what was the real plan? And it's like, that's what we'll never know. Other than just trying to get, like, slapdash get money off of random people.
If this was a genuine attempt, I think it makes most sense that they were only actually targeting a few of these people.
Mm-hmm. It's like in mystery shows, someone will kill multiple people to try to cover up the one murder they actually wanted to commit. You get an extortion letter. You get an extortion letter. Everyone gets an extortion letter.
Maybe they were into sci-fi and Poirot.
Well, they were not very good with the little gray cells.
I can kind of see, though, trying to take advantage of the mayor having recently passed away and trying to imply that they had caused it. But also at the same time, it sounds ridiculous. So never mind. they were hoping to take advantage of that happenstance. Mm-hmm. They're trying to take advantage of somebody's death in order to scare people into giving them money. And ultimately, it didn't work out. Doesn't make sense. They didn't get anywhere. They spent a lot of money on a computer processor and they went to jail. And that's it. That's the story. Good night. I'm going to bed.
Thank you for joining us
for this weird story. This was very hard for me to put together mm-hmm. because I'm a perfectionist. And do not misinterpret perfectionist as meaning that I am perfect. It means that I have a hard time producing anything that I don't consider to be perfect. I can't release something that I feel is imperfect. And I can't make something perfect. Nobody is perfect. I am imperfect.
And I'm the one that releases the episodes, so.
Oh, good.
There we go. Thank you for joining us. We hope you're all safe and healthy out there. A new surge of a new variant. Take care of yourself. Take care of each other.
Wear a mask.
Get vaccinated if you haven't already. Get your booster.
I can tell you for a fact, the vaccine does not give you a third arm. I'm very disappointed.
I know. It would have been so helpful. And no 5G. My cell phone works worse now. So just go ahead and go get that wonderful, scientifically proven mRNA vaccine. Take care of yourself and the people around you and be an amazing community and state and country and the world.
And maybe foster a dog.
Or a cat. Yeah.
Not related, but just maybe give it a try. It's fun.
Yeah.
Anywho, thanks for being here. And we'll talk to you next time. Okay, bye-bye. Bye. No, you hang up.
You hang up.
No, you hang up.
No, you hang up.
No, you hang up.
Okay, on the count of three.
One, two, three.